Hi, I'm Carr Wilson, Doctor of Behavioral Health, and I want to welcome you to Covenant Behavioral Health, started in 2011. We've been an industry leader in the mental health field, servicing active duty personnel, veterans, and their families. Our practice started in St. Louis, Missouri, and has expanded with offices in Iowa and California. Covenant Behavioral Health is a registered 501c3 agency, and we're committed to servicing active duty, military personnel, their dependents, and the local community at large through education and therapeutic services. We blend professional psychotherapy and psychoeducation material in an integrated healthcare setting to assist with relationships, healing wounds of the past, and enhancing our patients' quality of life. Here at Covenant Behavioral Health, we are committed to the preservation of families and relationships. Using practical, interactive, and solution-focused approach, we provide support and practical feedback to help our patients resolve current problems and change long-standing behavior patterns.
¿Quién somos? Covenant Salud y Comportamientos comenzó en 2011 y somos el líder de la carrera de salud. Y damos ayudas a veteranos y servicios activos y familias. Nuestra práctica comenzó en St. Louis, Missouri, y ha expandido a Iowa y California los pasados 6 años. Nos gustaría trabajar con ustedes para ayudarles a tener éxito personal y profesional.
Okay, so welcome back to section three. And we're talking about conflict resolution today. So conflict resolution, or conflict in general, is much like fighting. It's not in the sense that it's not what you do as how you do it, okay? So in other words, conflict's a natural part of relationships. It's a natural part of just living and being in relation to other people. You're going to have conflict because of personality differences. You're going to have conflict. So, but it's not a bad thing. It's just how we resolve those conflicts that make it good or bad. When we think that everything has to go our way, that's an issue. That's how we determine conflict. We resolve the issue. Is I got what I wanted? That is not conflict resolution. Conflict resolution is really this sort of win-win situation for everybody that's involved. And so what we're going to do is we're going to talk about the definition of conflict, what it is, and the process of finding a solution. There is an assessment that we give to couples at the some part of the session. We have them fill that out, and then we look at the different conflict styles. We have them identify what their conflict style is, what their partner's conflict style is, and then we really show them how to blend those together for a better outcome. So why don't we do this? Somebody read for me conflict and read that first chapter right there for what conflict is.
What is conflict? Conflict may be defined as a struggle or contest between people with opposing needs, ideas, beliefs, values, or goals. Conflicts within relationships are normal and for the most part inevitable. However, the results of conflicts are not predetermined. Conflict might escalate and lead to non-productive results, or conflicts can be beneficially resolved and lead to healthy relationship outcomes. Learning to manage conflict within your relationship and family systems is an integral part of balanced living. In its simplest form, conflict is a disagreement. Conflict does not necessarily involve fighting, but when someone begins to argue, becomes insistent about their point of view, it can indicate that the individual is unskilled at handling conflicts in a collaborative way. The same can be said about the silent treatment in conflict. This is a passive-aggressive approach to conflict. Conflict results because of miscommunication between people with regard to their needs, ideas, beliefs, goals, or values. Conflict resolution is based on the principle that all conflicts cannot necessarily be resolved, but learning how to manage conflicts can decrease the odds of a situation escalating.
And that's what we mean by, like, conflict itself is not a bad thing. It's just how we handle conflict
That's what makes it good or bad, all right? That determines whether it's good or it's bad. It's how we respond to it. Again, conflict is a natural part of a relationship, but again, it's how we resolve that conflict that makes it good, the technique that we use. So conflict is the process of trying to resolve a conflict. Ideally, conflict resolution is collaborative problem solving, a cooperative talking together process that leads to choosing a plan of action that both of you can feel good about. So that's what we mean by we talk about that win-win situation. You don't always walk away from conflict resolution with what exactly you wanted, but you walk away feeling like what you want was is respected, heard, and validated, and just as much as equally what the other person wants, needs, and expect is validated. Conflict resolution involves acquiring skills related to conflict management, self-awareness, conflict communication skills, and establishing a structure for managing conflict in your relationship. If you're going to enjoy your relationship, work, and other relationships, the less often you become irritable, argumentative, or go silent, the better your partnership will be for everybody that's involved. When conflict occurs, participants have the following options. Only one of these options leave both participants feeling good. The other four options are subpar resolution pathways. They create ill will, bad feeling, and a corrosive impact on relationships. So if you don't mind, I'm going to have somebody go ahead and read those for me. Start with conflict resolution, and then we'll have somebody else jump in there. So we have those four styles: conflict resolution, we have the fighting, we have the submitting, and the flight, and the freeze. All right.
Number one, collaborative resolution. Talking together can bring a disagreement out in the open in a friendly manner so that both parties understand each other's concerns and then can conclude by finding a mutually agreeable solution. This process is the gold standard for what people generally aim for when they talk about conflict resolution.
And when we talk about conflict, remember what happens is that whenever there is conflict, we have a choice to stay here or to go here. Here, we think more rationally. We rationalize things. We think about what's best for us and what's best for the other person. Or we have the option of going here. And here is very selfish. This is where the fight, flight, or freeze, or submit comes into place. And so let's delve in just a little deeper here. So number two, when we talk about fight, participants bicker, get mad, even fight about whose way will win, bullying their way to resolution via coercive powering over, all right? And let's look at number three. Somebody read number three.
Submit. Participants avoid a potentially hurtful fight by giving up on getting what they want, ending the disagreement with the byproduct of one person feeling sad and depressed.
Number four.
Flight. Participants flee by self-distraction, escaping from dealing with the dilemma by busying themselves with some other activity, like an addiction or an obsessive-compulsive habit.
And freeze. Participants become immobilized in anxiety and tension by staying away from the problem and at the same time not talking about it. Shared decision-making is the optimal process for shared problem-solving. For this process to work, participants need to stay collaborative, like they're sitting on the same side of the table, facing the problem, and flipping, and never flipping into oppositional or hostile stance toward each other. That's the key to this process, is that we have to look at the issue, the problem, from a partnering point of view, all right? So setting a conflict without getting mad, sad, or anxious generally involves following three steps. Number one, recognizing that there is a problem that needs to be solved. to begin the process of conflict resolution, you need to recognize that a conflict exists. Don't run from conflict. We really need to help couples recognize it. Well, I'm not confrontational. I love to hear that. I'm not confrontational, because if you're not confrontational, then something's wrong with you. Let's talk about it. If you're not confrontational, then something's wrong with you. If you're not confrontational, then what happens to you? Oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir. Your needs don't get met. Your feelings don't get validated. You don't have a voice. So you got to normalize, especially, and a lot of times you'll see this, you know, and I got to admit, it's just half and half. You'll have men who are not confrontational. You'll have women in the relationship who are not confrontational. It's just that there's somebody in the relationship that's more typically more dominant than the other person. And then, and you know how opposites sort of attract? I think there's some truth to that. I think you see more opposites. This one person who's very vocal, verbalizes a lot in the relationship, and you have somebody who doesn't do that a whole lot. And they'll tell you, well, I'm just not very confrontational. You know, I don't like conflict. There's nothing wrong with conflict. It's all about how you do it that makes it right or wrong. And so you really got to encourage people to become okay with conflict and okay with confrontation. Confrontation does not mean you have to yell, scream, throw stuff, break things to get your point across. Confrontation simply means that you've got to be able to be willing to state how you feel, respect how you feel equally as much as you do the other person, okay? So, recognizing that a problem needs to be resolved, and to begin the process of conflict resolution, you need to recognize that. Sometimes the hardest thing to do is to stay in a positive tone of voice. So if you feel yourself becoming tense, irritated, instead of continuing in the attack or defensive mode, you want to pause and say to yourself, here's an opportunity to use my new skill. My irritation indicates that there is a conflict here. So when you feel that in your gut, when the hair stands up on your arm, knowing, like I tell people, this is a great time. I love it when I see it in sessions, when there's conflict, when there's disagreement. Because no, let's ride this. Let's deal with this. This is a great opportunity for us to learn and to use the skills that we've been learning the last couple of weeks on how to resolve issues. So you got to capitalize on that is what you got to do, all right? Don't be afraid. We're talking about with couples, but this really plays well with your children. It plays well with your parents. It plays well with your coworkers. Anybody who you come in contact with in using these skills. Don't run from conflict. Think of it, and we're talking about that paradigm shift in the way we think and the way we see. It's an opportunity for you to become a better version of you. A better version of you. Giving yourself, because listen, sad to say, except for us, you know, professional helpers, we believe in giving people a voice, validating how they feel, but we're not there with them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We're not. And so we have to teach them and give them the skills to give themselves a voice, stand up for what they feel and how they believe. We have to do that. And so teach people, we have to teach couples in couples therapy that conflict is not a bad thing. It is an opportunity for you to really grow and become a better version of yourself. All right? So when you feel that irritation, just know that this is an opportunity, a possibility to become a better version of you. All right, to really home in and work on the skills of expressing yourself, okay? Number two, exploration of the underlying concerns. This step requires a change that looks at possible solutions to exploring the underlying concerns that your initial suggestions that have been meant to accomplish. Solutions are plans of actions. Concerns are underlying desires, fears, and other factors that matter to you in a given situation. So we talk about underlining concerns, all right? Underlining concerns are those initial suggestions that have been meant to accomplish something, all right? And then solutions are plans of actions, is what they are. Concerns deal with the underlying fears or desires or factors that matter to you in any given situation. Number three, creation of a mutually agreeable solution. Agreements and resolution come to when two people involved in a conflict create a plan of action that includes ways that meet the underlying concerns of both parties. All right? That's how we come to those agreements, those resolutions, is that when we can come up with a situation or a scenario or a plan that will meet the underlying concerns of both parties. This is what we talk about when we say the win-win situation. And that win-win situation, and I tell people this in conflict resolution, that it's not about a competition. It's not about a winner or a loser. Again, it's a partnership. And if you think about this, who wants to win against the most important person in their life? Because if there has to be a winner, then there has to be a loser. So, all right. Who wants to win against the most important person in their life? I don't want my wife to have to lose in order for me to win. You know, I don't. Because if she loses, guess what that means? In essence, I lose. Everybody loses, all right? So it doesn't have to be, and there is a place for competition in your relationship. That's just not it, though. There's in softball, in football, in basketball, there is golf, there is competition, and there has to be a winner and a loser, but not in your relationship. In your relationship, we have to have that paradigm shift to see each other as equals, as a partner, as a partnership, and that when we both win, everybody wins. And when one of us loses, everybody loses. All right? So that's what you really want to try to help people understand when it comes to, because there's a lot of negative connotation that comes along with conflict. People will tell you, I know you hear it too, I don't like conflict. I'll just say yes, I'll just go along with it just because I want to avoid conflict. But you really want to help them shift the way they look at conflict. You want them to shift the way they interpret conflict and the way they interact with conflict, because conflict is a wonderful opportunity to become a better version of who you are. It's a wonderful opportunity to really improve the way you two resolve issues, because it doesn't go away. You know, it's going to always be there as those moments within your relationship, those life-changing moments when you have kids, when you change jobs, when you move, all those highlighted moments within our lives happen, there's going to be some conflict there. And if you just have everybody just sort of going along, not saying, one person going along, not saying anything, not having a word, not having a say-so, then it really makes for a miserable life. Any questions? We talk about conflict resolution. So let's look here at some of the things you can do when you go into, when you have conflict, all right? So, and most people don't, I'm going to say, not most people, but some people don't know how to resolve conflict. Here we got some very simple steps on how to resolve conflict. How to take, number one, is you got to learn when to take a time out, all right? Because immediately when you talk about conflict, the natural thing to do is to go here, to the emotional part of your brain. And defend yourself, all right? You're either a fighter or a submitter. That's what you are. So recognize your need for a timeout to get your thoughts together, to write them down, to take some time and really explore how you feel and how much this means to you, all right? And then number two, request a timeout. You know, say, hey, you know what? I'm too angry right now to talk. I need to take some time. Give me an hour to calm down and gather my thoughts. Go write them down. Use Siri, use Google to record them for you. And remember to call a timeout for yourself. It seldom helps to tell the other person you need a timeout. When you point your finger and you say you, you automatically put that person on the defensiveness. You have now attacked them, and guess what? They leave from here, and they go here. I need a timeout. You need a timeout. You know, and now we've started this, you know, we started this fight now, this argument here, you know. So never tell the other person that they need a timeout. Only talk about yourself, all right? And I'll say this, too. Try to stay with, like, especially when you're using the I statements, try to stay away from you and pointing your finger. You need to do this. You didn't do that, and pointing your finger. Because what happens is that, and you may not intend for it to happen, but be careful. Like, watch yourself when you're talking to people, when you're doing like this. Because you automatically, this sends a subliminal message that they're in trouble and that they're wrong when you say you and when you point your finger. But when you talk about I and why you feel this way and why you want this to have happened, that keeps that person from being on the defensiveness while you're talking. Is what it does, and it helps them stay in the rational part of their brain. So then relax and calm down, take a deep breath, go for a jog or a walk, take a bath, write in your journal, read, pray, watch television for a while, do something that will help you relax and recover, help you come back from here and back up here is what you want to do, to help you reset is what we call it, to increase the oxygen in your brain, to increase the serotonin in your brain is what you want, all right? And then remember what's important. Try to identify what you were thinking and feeling that became so difficult to discuss. Think about the I statements and try to spend time, quiet time, considering your partner's point of view. Because again, when we talk about our partnership understands that it is important that the other person is just as successful as I am. When we talk about a partnership, okay? And so, and we're talking about this, there are some relationships where, you know, this probably doesn't work very well because you have that one person who sort of makes all the decisions in the relationship. They are the controller in the relationship, and it's really all about them because you have everybody else that's in the relationship with them. They sort of submit to them is what they do, to that authority figure within the relationship. But when we talk about the partnership, though, you really want, and that's why I think it's important to understand, like, the fundamental thoughts of the people that you're counseling. Because you will be surprised how many times people will come to you and their fundamental thoughts about marriages are so different. And I think it's like, you two should never got married. Like, this is not going to work. This is going to be hell until one of you die. Literally. I'll get a divorce. Because their concept, their ideology about marriage is so different. And this is the reason why we encourage and we teach premarital counseling. Before you get married, you need to understand the fundamental thoughts and beliefs about what marriage is. And you will be surprised just how different they are. And when they're that different, guess what you're going to have? Lots of conflict. Not necessarily a bad thing, but you need to understand about blending that together, compromising, and having the win-win situation. But, you know, I can think of one particular couple right now, a military couple who came in. She's Vietnamese, and he is Anglo-American, and his very traditional family, where very traditional 50s type mentality, where he works, he makes the money, he makes all the decisions when it comes to the kids, food, how the house looks, and everything. And she, of course, her family, just a little different. Just a little different. She's very loud. She's very articulate. They share decision-making in her family. And I can tell you right now, I have no idea. I told them, I have no idea why you got married. You should not be married. Because she has a voice. She gets to say, and that is not how his mom and dad was raised. His dad is a decision maker. His dad makes the decision for everything, where the dishes go and everything. And that's the kind of stuff we're in counseling sessions about, is where the dishes go. And I'm like, this is what we're, yeah. So it's very important early on to know. And let me tell you right there, that does not mean it's because this is how you were born, this is how you are. It does not mean that's how you have to be. So you are the change maker, the therapist. You're the change maker in the relationship here. And so if you can find that entry point where you can have them sort of shift and revamp the way they think about relationships and partnership, then there's a great opportunity for you to do that. That's not always the case, but this is where you got to check to see, like, are you willing to compromise? Are you willing to change? Because my question is, where is that, this is a deal breaker? Where is that, this is a, because if this is a deal breaker, then why are we keep trying to find conflict resolution and work through this? If this is a deal breaker, then this is a deal breaker. But if it's not a deal breaker, then of course we can work through it. We can find resolution. We can work on this. We can teach you lots of ways to improve the quality of your relationship. But if this is a deal breaker, then we need to know that early on. Like, is this a deal breaker for you? If it's a deal breaker for you, then you really need to cut your losses, is what you need to do. But if it's not a deal breaker, then okay, let's continue to work on it. Then let's continue to try to improve this. So, we talked about those: relax and calm down, take a deep breath, go for a jog, do something to help you relax, recover, and then come back when you're calm and re-enter into the conflict resolution mode. Remember what's important to you and resume the conversation. And then, of course, here we got some homework that patients can do. And again, it's so important to make sure, and if you don't like this homework or you want to get more homework in addition to that, then feel free to do that. And of course, we have tons of stuff that's available on the shared drive where you can get that information, okay? And share it with them. Any questions about conflict resolution? I'll have them do the conflict styles assessment, and where we can find out which one that they are. There are five styles: the collaborating style, problems of resolve in a way which have an ultimate optimal result and provided everyone involved with a way to get what they want, all right? Both sides get what they want, and negative feelings are minimized when we use the collaborative style. The pros to that: create mutual trust, maintain positive relationships, and builds commitment. The cons to that is that it's time consuming and energy consuming when we talk about that. That's why things are not resolved overnight. It may take you 10 to 12 sessions to resolve an issue. And remember, you didn't come up with this problem overnight, so you're not going to resolve it overnight. Typically, it's going to take some work to really resolve those issues. And this is where, again, it's this particular course is really about helping people shift in the way they think about problems and the way they interact with each other. And so you're teaching them to be patient with themselves and to be patient with their significant other as they go through the process of change, all right? Because we're changing the way they think. We're changing the way they look at each other. We're changing a lot of times. We're changing their foundation because they had this sort of, you know, maladaptive way of thinking that conflict resolution was all about them getting what they wanted. And that's how they know they resolved the issues, that they got what they wanted. And like, that's real for some people. That's how they always saw their mom get it that way, or they always saw their dad get it that way. And so now they've been taught that conflict resolution means you get what you want. And then, of course, you're coming along and you're bursting their bubbles, teaching them that, no, that's not conflict. That's called, you know, no, that's not conflict resolution. Conflict resolution is where we both walk away, where there is compromise, where there is a collaborative effort for both of us to decrease animosity and negative feelings. That's conflict resolution. Conflict resolution does not mean you get what you want. And so you're having to change the way they think, change the way they feel. And so it is time consuming. That's why the collaborative style takes a lot of work. And then you have the competing styles. This is the authoritarian approach. It's goal-oriented and quick. The cons to it is that it breeds hostility. And then, of course, you have the avoiding style. The avoiding style is the non-confrontational approach. The pros to it is it typically it doesn't escalate, it postpones the difficulty. And then the cons to that is that you have those issues that are not being addressed, and then you have those unresolved problems. And then you have the harmonizing style, giving into maintaining the relationship. And the pros, it minimizes injury when they are outmatched and relationships are maintained. The cons, it breeds resentment and exploits the weak, or I should say more of the passive person. Harmonizing can be good in some situations. It really can, because you really want, you know, you'll prefer your significant other over yourself. But you got to be careful with that harmonizing, just to have everything good, to have everything calm, to have everything sort of go the other person's way, just because you want what's best for them, is not always good. Okay? It can really be exploited. And then, of course, we have the compromising style. This is the middle ground approach. Pros are useful in complex issues without simple solutions. All parties are equal in power. And the cons to that is that no one is ever really satisfied, and less than optimal solutions get implemented. And so we are one or two or several of these styles. And I think it's important. That's why we have this assessment, where they can learn what their style is, and then they can learn what their partner style is. And I think it's important to really teach people that there is no right or wrong style. It just depends upon what situation that you're in. You know? It depends upon what situation, what you're trying to resolve. And so you need to be able to try on a different style. Like, you have your primary, your go-to style for resolving issues, and that could be competitive style. You sort of just tell people what to do to get things done. But then you really need to be able to try on other styles too, maybe more harmonizing or compromising styles is what you need to try on. So you need to have, you have your go-to, but then you need to be able to try on different styles. And you can ask people, people can generally just look at these and tell you which one they are. And so I'll have the partner identify themselves and identify the other person in the relationship, what they are too. And then we'll talk about them. And again, I'll say, normalize it, that there's not a right or wrong style. It just depends upon where you are. Any questions about the conflict resolution? So again, conflict, nothing bad. It's just how we do it, how you respond to it, is what makes it good or bad. All right, let's look at session four. Session four is love languages. Well, before we go there, let me just go back here. Make sure that as you go through the workbook, that you give the parties involved a chance to really talk about the information, to elaborate on there. And it really helps if you interject and make yourself a part of that situation. One of the things that I do, one particular couple I'm working with, they've been married for over 40 years, is I tell them right now, for the next 12 weeks, I am a part of this family. My voice will be heard and respected just as much as I hear and respect your voice. And so we all take part in reading the homework assignment. We all take part in reading whatever we're discussing. Everybody has something to say. Nobody is just sitting there in session. So we all have something to say. We all have something to add to the topic that we're discussing. And we talk about the homework, and they go away, they do that homework, and then when they come back, they bring that homework into session, and we discuss that homework. And a lot of times, not a lot of times, but sometimes, that homework doesn't get discussed the very next session because something new has popped up. And you need to deal with that new topic. Go ahead and deal with that new topic, but do make sure that the next session that you have, you reiterate that we do need to talk about our homework and then process our homework. Because the homework, again, reinforces what you taught in session, giving practical skills and resolution. And so you want to then let them go home, practice that for a few days. And when they come back, you want to check to make sure that they're actually able to do it. And then look for, if they're not able to do it, then you may need to change something. You may need to modify something to make it even more applicable for them. So homework is very important. Every single session, somebody should get homework. Every single session, somebody should. And it's nice, you know, before COVID-19, we were able to give out handouts. People came to the office. But now today, it's all electronic. So, you know, you send it to them by email. But you need to try to get a copy of that. Try to get a copy of that. Put it in their folder, their electronic folder is what you want to do. And get it. I like to get it before they come in because then it gives me a chance to sort of go over it before I actually sit down with them and mark it up and then talk about issues and things that I see in that session with them. So homework is very important. And even if you're not given a PDF or something like that, maybe it's a book to read, maybe it's an audio book to listen to, maybe it's, you know, some mindfulness techniques or something like that that they're trying. And then again, same thing though, when they come back, you need to check in on that homework to make sure that it's working for them. And if it's not working, then you need to make adjustments to it. Any questions about homework? Okay. So we're talking about the love languages here. And really getting back to the heart of the matter as to why couples come into counseling. Couples come into counseling because typically there is this breakdown in communication. There is this lack of communication. And when you talk about, you know, all of the symptoms as to why they come, you know, infidelity, I think is a symptom of a larger issue. We talk about, you know, family dynamics as to why couples come. When you get down to the heart of the matter, you find out that it's really about communication. And even when we talk about the intimate parts of relationship, again, there is this failure to really express what's important to you as an individual within the relationship. And it all boils down to communication. And that's why it's so very important that we understand and we learn what our love language is. Because we'll say, well, he just doesn't love me. And I hear that a lot. You know, I bring, well, and we're not in love anymore. And here's where I'm really trying to understand our concept of love. I teach a marriage and family course. And it's one of the questions I always ask my students is, define for me what love is. And you hear lots of definition of what love is, you know, lots of different definitions of what love is. And do you know that love really is so ambiguous that it's different from person to person? Mm-hmm. It really is. There's not a one definition of love. As a matter of fact, if you look in the English, in the American English definition of love, you'll find that it has typically one definition, and it's all about sex. But when you go to more mature civilizations around the world, they have multiple definitions of the word love. You look at the Greek definition of love, there's like seven definitions of love. Seven definitions of love. So love looks different, it feels different, and it is different from person to person. Not only as far as the sexes are concerned, but then our cultural interpretation. Experiences define for us what love is. A lot of us watch, you know, our mom and dad and the way they interact and define, you know, what love is. And you need to ask your couple, what is love to you? What does it look like? How do you know you're being loved? And then you do that for the other person, you'll see these stark different interpretations of love. Again, which goes back to why premarital counseling is so important to make sure that everybody has a clear expectation of what a relationship looks like and what it means to be married and all those good things, just so that you don't have those got you and those moments of, I didn't know that's how you felt. I didn't know that's how you thought. Because we go in thinking, which is very natural, that, well, your definition of love is the same as mine. Don't you know what love is? Love is this. Love is that. And you're like, no, that's not love. That's called friendship. Love is, and then they have their definition of what love. And you're like, that's not love. Well, I guess it can be love, but real love is, you know, if you look at people's definitions of love, it is so different and so varied among individuals, and especially the sexes. And that's why we have this love language assessment tool. And so we'll have them go through the love language. And this is Gary Chapman developed this. He's wrote a book and he's revised a book about love language. So we have these, and he identified five different types of love. And so if you look here, we talk about those. And what we try to do is we try to identify, number one, what our love language is, and then what our partner's love language, because what we interpret as love is often different than what they interpret as love. I'll be transparent here. I'll share me with me. I remember when I was going to school, working two jobs, I had a family, and I mean, I was just working, trying to complete school, trying to get through, trying to finish up early, deadline. And I remember thinking, I'm doing this because I love my family. I'm doing this because I love my wife. That's why I'm doing this. I remember my wife walking around so sad and so depressed this year. And whenever I would ask, like, what's wrong, she'd say, nothing. And you know, that for me as a third frustrates me, because I know something's wrong. You're telling me nothing's wrong, but you're walking around here with a long face and everything. And when I ask you what's wrong, nothing. And so one time we had this big blowout. I'm like, what's wrong with you? And he said, I just don't feel like you love me. I go, what do you mean I don't love you? I'm working two jobs. I'm going to school. Don't this mean that I love you? You think I'm doing this because I just want to? So I was offended. And I said, so what does love mean to you? Well, you don't touch me anymore. I don't have time. I'm working two jobs. I'm going to school. Like, I'm loving you, you know, is what I'm doing. But her definition of love was distinctly different than my definition of love. And you'll notice that when you're dealing with couples, like, what do you mean? I don't love you. Don't I do this? Don't I do that? Don't I do this? And you're talking to them like, yeah, but that's not love for me, though. That doesn't mean love. And so that's why it's so incredibly important that we help couples understand what their love language is and what their spouse's love language is. And so we go ahead and we just go through here is what we do. All right? So let's read a little bit of this. So somebody start and just read that first read that first paragraph for me.
Okay, so what is your primary love language? What makes you feel most loved by your partner? What do you desire above all else? If the answer to those questions does not leap to your mind immediately, perhaps it will help to look at the negative use of love languages. What does your partner do or say, or fail to do or say, that hurts you deeply? Ignoring our partner's love languages is like ignoring the needs of a garden. If we don't weed, water, or fertilize, it will die a slow death. When you're trying to figure out your primary love language, it helps to look back over your marriage and ask, what have I most often requested of my partner? Whatever you have most requested is probably in keeping with your primary love language. Those requests have probably been interpreted by your partner as nagging, but in fact, they have been your efforts to secure emotional love from your partner. Another way to discover your primary love language is to examine what you do or say to express love to your partner. Chances are, what you are doing for her is what you wish she would do for you. If you are constantly doing acts of service for your partner, perhaps, although not always, that is your love language.
Mm-hmm.
If words of affirmation speak love to you, chances are you will use them in speaking love to your partner. Thus, you may discover your own language by asking, how do I consciously express my love to my partner?
And stop right there, Adon. Because this is very true. If you notice how people interpret their love, that's really how they interpret love for themselves. So when you say, I love you by doing this, and when your partner doesn't give you that, they have their own way of loving you. But the way that you do it is the way that you interpret love. So that's what you typically, not always, but that's what you typically expect in return. But you got to remember that the way they define love, their love language is distinctly different from yours. And this is why understanding yourself, your own love language, and then your significant other's love language is so very important. Because I do think it is okay to have your own definition of love, okay?
I think oftentimes it also relates to what they didn't get in their childhood.
Yeah, it does. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. Absolutely. It does. Me and Reverend was just talking about, even when we talk about the attachments, forms of relationships, how those impact what we saw growing up. Remember, 70% of what we learn is through social learning. So it's what we saw, you know, it's what we experienced, it's what we got growing up. And so, that can certainly impact then your paradigm for love and for how you interpret love. And I think you are right, Adon. You know, a lot of times we try to give what we try to get what we didn't receive growing up. We didn't get that, those affirmations. And if you look at typically, and I do like to classify them, as much as our society today likes to say that men and women are not different, science says that they are different. Their brains are different. The way they interpret, the way they process things are distinctly different. And I'm happy to debate this with anybody. Just go to my website, www.covenantbehavioralhealth.org, or you can call me at 760-241-6044, and I'm happy to discuss that with you. Because there is a difference in the way that men and women think and process. And I don't care if you do make other changes. That right there, unless you do a brain transplant, you cannot separate the two, okay? So with that being said, for men, typically, you'll find that words of affirmation really matter to them. Because guess what we talked about this a little earlier, men don't get that growing up. They don't get that, you know? Girls always tell how beautiful they are and how smart they are and all those. And guys are just told how strong they are, you know, that kind of stuff like that. And so men typically like words of affirmation. All right. And that's how they interpret love, that physical touch. And for women, it's a little bit different. And it's okay that they're different. We just, again, I'm really trying to stress how important it is for us to understand that there is a difference and then respect those differences, okay? So, but how can we speak each other's love language when we are full of hurt, anger, resentment, or past failures? Love doesn't erase the past, but it makes the future different. When we choose active expressions of love in the primary love language of our partner, we create an emotional climate we can deal with past conflicts and failures. The in-love experience is on the level of, let me say this. I was talking about earlier about how I'll get these many definitions of what love is. And for the most part in America, we interpret love as sex. But love really goes beyond, sex is a very, you can have sex with people without loving them, you know? Like, that's not the definition of love. But poorly, though, that's how we interpret love, though, is by this, the chemical reaction of the oxytocin in our brain, where the hormones are raging. Like, that's how we interpret love. And I think Hollywood has done a disservice, not Hollywood itself, but just watching movies from Hollywood have really done us a disservice, and having those as role models has done us a disservice, because you look, their relationships typically last about 3 years, and then they're on to another relationship. And it's because the oxytocin in their brain has stopped producing. And for us, our definition of love is really if we feel it. That's how we define love. We define love as this feeling. Well, I felt, and oh man, about 3 years, you'll have people come to your office after 3 years of being married, and guess what they will say? I fell out of love. I'm going, you did? Well, how did that happen? How did you fall out of love? Well, we fell in love. I go, okay, so that's your mistake. We fell in love at this, you know, particular place, and this happened. I go, well, I think you're misinterpreting the chemicals in your brain as love. And oxytocin is not really love. Oxytocin is really there for a lot of other reasons, although you get the fluctuation. You have the you hang up first. No, you hang up first. You have a, I love you more. That's oxytocin in your brain. That's your hormones raging. That's a chemical that's really there to really help you battle stress more than anything. But for us, we interpret that as love. And so once your brain stops producing that, then we don't have that feeling anymore. And we say, now we've fallen out of love. And so I'll say, okay. So now you're on the road of learning to love, because love really is this learned behavior. You learn to love, and it is a very, very, very challenging role in learning to love. And again, which is how we get to this whole in love concept, all right? It says here that the in love experience temporarily meets one's emotional need for love. It gives us the feeling that someone cares and that someone admires and appreciates us. Our emotion soars with the thoughts that another person sees us as number one, that he or she is willing to devote the time and energy exclusive to our relationship. And for a brief period, however long it lasts, our emotional need for love is met. I'll ask couples when they're sitting there in an office with me, John, how do you know that so-and-so loves you? And I'll ask the other person, how do you know that your spouse loves you? And that is a very, very tough question for people to answer. But I'll have to stop, because I mean, we can't go any further until we define like what love is. And how do they know that they're, because they're probably being loved, but guess what? Their interpretation of love is so different that they don't even know that they're being loved. And so you need to be able to ask people, like, how do they define love? Do you, I'll ask couples again, do you feel safe enough to share how you feel? And 9 times out of 10, couples do not feel safe enough to share how they feel. Another real big red flag signs right there, when you don't feel safe enough to share how you feel. Another question I will ask, do you feel like you are a priority in your significant other's life? And if they can say yes, we're good. But when they hesitate and they say, I don't know, or they say no, that's a problem. That's a problem, that you don't know that you are a priority in your significant other's life. We've got to get to the point to where they feel as if they are a priority in the other person's life. Because again, we're talking about the most important person in the world, right? Who you've entered into a relationship with, and that you sometimes have planned to spend the rest of your life with. Nobody goes into a relationship going, you know what, in 3 years we're going to get divorced, but we're going to have fun until then. Nobody does that. Everybody goes into marriage thinking that this is going to be forever, is what everybody goes into marriage for. Nobody goes, oh, this is a time relationship, 7 years and it expires, and then I have to start all over again, you know? So you need to know, like, are you a priority in this relationship, is what you need. And then what it looks like when you are a priority, so you know that you are a priority. And it's good to hear it. But it's even better to see it and feel it and know it, you know, that you are a priority. So if you turn the page, we sort of go through understanding the 5 love languages. Number 1, words of affirmation. We talked about those. Actions don't always speak louder than words. If this is your first love language, unsolicited compliments mean the world to you. Hearing the words, I love you, are important to hear, and the reasons behind the love sends the spirit skyward. Insults that can leave you shattered and are not easily forgotten. So verbal compliments or words of appreciation are powerful communicators of love. They are best expressed in simple, straightforward statements of affirmation, such as, you look good in that suit. And how many guys love to hear, man, you're so strong, right? And babe, you always do the best job. And the project looks a hot mess. You could have did it yourself, but just stroking his ego really makes him feel good, though, you know? And do you ever look incredible in that dress? Wow. I really like how you're always on time and you when you pick me up from work. Just giving them those words of affirmation mean the world from them. And you need to find out, like, here we're talking about the couple. They need to find out, like, what is their spouse's or significant other's love language, all right? And then number two, quality time. This is, I admit, this is one of my big ones right here, quality time. So by quality time, I mean giving someone your undivided attention. I don't mean sitting on the couch watching TV together. When you spend time that way, Netflix, HBO has your attention, not your partner. What I mean is sitting on the couch with the TV off, looking at each other and talking, putting your devices away and giving each other the undivided attention that they need. It means taking a walk with just the two of you, going out to eat. It means time is a commodity to you. And we all have multiple demands on us. Each of us has the exact same time in the day, which is 24 hours a day. And we have to decide what's a priority for us, all right? We have to decide, because if you say that your relationship and your significant other is a priority, then they need to know that they are a priority. Not your job that you're working 10 to 12 hours a day, and not everything else, because everybody is bidding for just a little bit more of Carl. Everybody wants a piece of Carl. But if I say that my spouse, my children are the most important thing to me, then guess where most of my time should be spent? It's with my spouse and my children. And for me, quality time is like, I could be a bum with nothing. Don't have to have a house, a car, or anything, as long as I got my family. As long as I got my kids, my wife, I am the happiest person in the world. So quality time is my, like, for, they always, what do you want for Christmas? What do you want? As long as you're here, and for years it's been that way. As long as you're here, that's all I want. I don't want no presents. I don't want no gifts. I want us all to be able to spend time together. Holidays, same thing. Talk about Christmas. I don't want to do, as long as we're together, I'm happy. I don't need anything else. And so we have to make the most important person a priority is what we have to do. And you have to, because you're going to cheat somewhere, so you have to choose where you're going to cheat. If you don't cheat your job, your friends, extended family, all those other places, then what you end up doing is cheating the most important people in the world to you. All right, so talk about quality time is another one. Receiving gifts, and I gotta admit, this is my wife. This is her love language, she loves gifts. And I don't care, they could be the most minute, small gifts. You could wrap up a leaf and give it to her, and she is happy as can be. So when we talk about, and you know, and me, and I'm so the opposite. I don't even want gifts. I just want the time. So, but I have to learn her love language. I have to get her a gift. Yeah, my son's looking at me. I said most recently for the longest time that's been the case. It did change. It did change this year. It did change this year. I only asked for a couple of things I had on my list this year. So, but normally, though, that's not the case. Normally, it's not the case. Then there's acts of services, which is another really big one. So it says Michelle's primary love language was, I call acts of service. By acts of service, I mean doing things you know your partner would like to do. You seek to please them by serving them and to express your love by doing things for them. All right, like cooking. I heard some guys say, and I hear this a lot. Guys will say, I'm like, how do you know your wife loves? Oh, the house is clean, dinner's made. When I come home every evening, my shoes are laid out. It's just acts of service. That's how they interpret love, you know? And again, I think that goes back to the whole, just how men were, how guys were sort of raised and sort of taught growing up, you know, not to really express love as sort of intangible, but they, you know, as more tangible things is how they interpret love. So you consider cooking a meal, setting a table, emptying a dishwasher, vacuum, and I've heard women say this too. If you take out the trash, that'll help. That I know he loves me then. If he unloads the dishwasher, you know, like do something, you know, other than me having to do everything here. So that's what we have when we call our acts of service. You actually do stuff for them, and that interprets love. And then, of course, we have the physical touch, which we talked about earlier, the physical touch. And it doesn't always mean intercourse. Physical touch can be lots of other ways in which we express our love. So those are the five types of love languages. And you can have more than one, again. And there is no right or wrong. They're different, and we just need to respect that when it comes to each other, that our love language is distinctly different. Okay, so we will do that in session, and then we will share that information with each other. That's what we'll do. So now you have the way that you communicate love, but now you also understand the way that they interpret love. Okay, so now you have two jobs. And I'm not saying you can't do what you want to do to show you love her, but you also need to add to that how she interprets that love too. All right. And then there's an assessment, like I said, there's an assessment here that we'll do, and then we will share that information in session. That's what we'll do. Let's take a break right here and grab something to eat, and then we got one more session to do, and we'll knock that out, and then we're going to call it a day. Let's take a break right now. So welcome back to session 5. As we make ready, we're going to get ready to close out today's training, a cognitive behavior approach to relationships. And the theme really has been about helping people have this paradigm shift in the way they view, see, and interact within relationships. And so if you're going to do that, you really have to identify what their core beliefs are and then sort of help chip away at those maladaptive, unhealthy ideologies and behaviors. Let me take any questions that we may have for anything that we've discussed already, any questions about any of the sessions, or even if it's not on these particular topics right here, I'm more than happy to address those before we wrap up here and do session 5. So as we close out here, one of the things I will do in session 5 is I will go over the contractual agreement of our relationship or our expectations for being in a relationship together. Again, we've talked a lot about the differences of the way we think and the way we react and respond to things. They're different from individual to individual. And so one of the things you really want to make sure that couples have as they move forward is this living contract agreement. And this living contract agreement, I know some people get hang-ups about contract, agreement, covenant, and you can just call it whatever you want to call it. I like to call it a contract because I noticed that in our society, we will sign contracts for really some important things in life. You know, we sign a contract for houses, we sign a contract for cars, we even sign a contract for our cell phone carriers. But then when it comes to, again, relationships, the most important things in our life, we're like, I don't want to sign no contract. Why we got to have a contract agreement for a relationship? And my question is, why wouldn't you have an express expected agreement for what is the makeup of your relationship, you know, for scenario after scenario, for how you're going to respond to things. And so this contractual agreement is something that you want to do in order to understand the top relational desires of your significant other. And so if you look at session 5, I will typically have them do this, not in session because it takes a lot of thought, but I'll have them do this as homework. And then I'll have them bring it back to me in session. And here they sort of go through, it says, below is a list of wants and desires that a large number of people have identified as very important to them. Please read each statement below and rate the importance of each relational desires, 1 from the lowest and 10 from the highest in importance to you. And once you've gone through each item, then you rank your top 10 most important desires. So, of course, they could all be 9s, they could all be 5s, they could all be 10s for that matter. And if they are, then you just need to rank the top 10 of your 10 important things, okay? So if you look here, you see that there's 1 to 27. It says, I have a desire to. And this is what you want. This is what you need in the relationship in order to feel safe, loved, and respected. So you identify what you need, and then you identify from 1 to 10, from lowest important to 10, highest important, okay? And then if you look down, we have, I have a desire from my spouse, and this is what your expectations are from your significant other. And so you go through, and you, again, you rate from 1 to lowest to 10, the most important or high importance for you. And while we've taken the liberty of, you know, actually coming up with a bunch of these things from research, but then you can also put add your own stuff in there too. You know, whatever is important to you, you can add that. And then it says, which needs are the most important to you And then you write those down again, you know, from 1 to 10, your top 10 most important ones. And so what I'll do is I will have couples look at, share their top 10 relational desires with their significant other. And you can see typically the stark difference is what you can see. Every now and then I do get couples that are like, man, look at you guys. This is scary. You guys, like, you think the same, you want the same thing, you know, because you just don't see it that often, you know, that couples are so in tune with each other. They know, they sort of have the same battle rhythm, so to speak, for life. Typically, it's so different. It's what I expect for it to be so different. And again, just because it's different doesn't mean that it's wrong. It just means that it's different. That's all. And I know that in our society today, if you ask people what's important, they will tell you what in a relationship. That having similarities is important. They will tell you that compatibility is the most important thing in a relationship. I have people come in all the time. We're just not compatible. I mean, you didn't know this before you got married? Is this new? Did you just wake up one morning and go, oh, we're not compatible? I mean, you knew this before you got married, that you were not compatible. Relationships are not built upon compatibility. Relationships are built upon commitment. Remember, we talked about those 3 years, the oxytocin in your brain? Well, once that fades, that's when the hard road of learning to love starts, and you have commitment now. It's about learning to love. It's a hard road. Relationships are not for the faint in heart. They are not. They're difficult. They're hard. They're challenging. They're rewarding. They're awesome. They're beautiful. They're everything up under the sun, relationships are. But anything worth having is worth fighting and working for. So relationships are not about compatibility. They are about commitment. And so once I have them sort of go through their top 10 most important things, then we will talk about that contract, that relationship contract. And this relationship contract, I call it a living contract because it should be done in pencil. It should be flexible. It's going to change, especially when you first get together. Premarital counseling, premarital relationship, it's going to change a lot. After you say I do, it's going to change a lot. When you add children, it's going to change. When you move, it's going to change. As you get older, it's going to change. And so you really should do it in pencil, because it should be flexible and it should be changeable. Because things in life are going to change. Change is the only thing that is consistent in life. It's change. And I don't know how you think that, well, he just don't love me the way... He just don't love me the way he just, well, no, he doesn't love you. You don't act the same way you used to either. You know, it's like we should be growing. It's going to change. So it's okay. It's going to change. Change is something that should be expected. But people come into relationships thinking that honeymoon phase is what's going to be forever. And then I got to be the bearer of bad news. You need to be the bearer of bad news and say, listen, let me tell you that things are going to change. When I'm doing premarital counseling, I always prepare them for after they say I do. After you say I do, things change. There is this subconscious shift in your expectations that take place. And that's why you need to understand having this livable contract, this livable agreement, that it's written in pencil just for reasons like this, that things are going to change. I can tell you that when we first got together, I'm pretty traditional couple we are. And we sat down when we first were dating, round table in my apartment, and we sort of talked about, even before we were officially dating, like what was expected of each other. Like who was gonna clean. I mean, we did the smallest things that most people don't even discuss. We were talking about who's gonna shop. We didn't have kids yet. We weren't even dating yet. We're talking about who's gonna stay home with the kids, and you know, who's gonna do all these things. We had these clear expectations. We wrote them down on a yellow tab, a piece of paper, and she had her list and I had my list of what we expected. And we married those together, and we came up with this living contract agreement, both with the understanding that this could change. And let me assure you, the moment I said I do, all my good sense went out the window. The moment I said I do, everything changed. I mean, we had kids, for example, right? And we had this agreement that she would stay home, she would take care of the kids, she would homeschool. Tina was only able to homeschool for about 3 years. She's like, I can't do this. I got to have adult conversations. I need adult friends. I cannot stay home, you know? And I'm like, but you agreed that you were going to stay home and you're going to homeschool and you weren't going to work outside the house. She was like, oh, no, I need a job. I need two jobs, as a matter of fact. I cannot. She decided that staying home was not for her. And then I had to readjust because, you know, that I'm like, I couldn't go, well, that's not in the contract because you said you were going to. So we had to erase that. We had to have some conversations. And we had to find a compromise is what we had to do. And so one of the compromises, especially when it came to the kids, were, okay, so if we put them in school, then they have to go to parochial school and you have to pay for it. Because that wasn't a part of the agreement. So we compromised is what we did. Okay, then we'll let somebody else school them, but, you know, but you're going to have to bear the brunt of paying for that dough, you know, because that wasn't a part of our agreement. But you got to be flexible. You have to be willing to compromise. And so this living agreement is going to change. And if you can help people understand that it should change, because as their milestones take place within the relationship, then so will your expectations for each other change. Okay? And this is not to be used as a weapon. Like, no, see here, you said that. You know, it's not to be used as a weapon for each other, and you really got to guard against that, because some people, especially guys, you know, we have this linear thought process that this is the way it's supposed to be, this is what you said, and we want people to sort of stick to that, especially sometimes when your brain works on that linear pathway. You really need to understand that this is a living agreement, and if it's a living agreement, that means that it's going to have some change, all right? And understand that change is inevitable. So if you understand that, then you'll come up with, like, and it's okay, I'll tell them to start with 5, they can have 10, as many as they want, they can have, it doesn't matter. It's their living agreement, they have to live with it. But what I really try to do is get them to come up with those, like, she has her list, he has his list, and then we marry that together on what are the most important things in this relationship. How are you? What do you need in order to feel safe, loved, and respected in the relationship? And when you give them this, when they see this in black and white and they take it home, and it's something they can revisit often, it really reinforces that this is what I expect. This is what I need in order to feel loved, safe, and respected. And they can articulate that to their significant other, and the significant other, when they see that, they can say, this is what she needs. This is what she expects in order to feel safe, love. And there's no question, so I didn't know that's how you felt, because you hear that a lot, especially in session with me, where they haven't been having those conversations, and then they get in sessions and they start opening up and sharing, and you hear, well, I didn't know that's how you felt. I didn't know that's what you thought. I didn't know you believed that. It's like, well, don't you guys talk to each other? It's like, how are you in a relationship and you don't even talk to each other? You don't even know what each other wants, needs, and desires are in a relationship, what you expect. And I love it, love it, love it. Of course, I'm being facetious. I hate it, hate it, hate it when couples enter into a monogamy relationship, but only one person was aware that it was a monogamous relationship. And the other person, well, you knew I was dating. You knew I came. You know, it ain't in a man's nature to have one woman. You know, and I wish we could joke, but it's no joke. I mean, literally, there are people who enter into relationships, and my thing is this. Yeah, no, I don't agree with it. Okay, but it's my personal beliefs. But I do believe that if you have the agreement that you have an open relationship, the chances of it working are significantly higher if both parties know that it's an open relationship. But if only one person knows that it's an open relationship, that is the recipe for a disaster. So it's so important that we understand and we know what's expected in the relationship. And so I say, okay, so this started on shaky ground. This started on shaky ground because one of us didn't know. All right? But if we both went into the relationship, you know, knowing that this was gonna, you'll see. I mean, really, they have just as much a chance of surviving as a monogamous relationship does. Mm-hmm. But you just gotta know. This is the kind of stuff you need to know going into the relationship. Children, for example. I know you want no kids. What do you mean? This is the conversation you never had. And of course, this is up to us as therapists. Like, these are things that we need to be bringing up. And we can pull from our own experience on a lot of this stuff and sort of share, you know, like, well, when I got married or when I was in a relationship, you know, these are some things that share that because people, I'm shocked that people don't have that conversation. And then they wonder why, I don't know how we got here. In session with you, because they didn't have those kind of conversations. They didn't have those real conversations with each other to know what was expected. Expectations, relationships fail at a higher rate when we don't know what's expected out of each other. It's like they just thought fairy dust was after the priest or the clergy said, I now pronounce you. They thought that it was just gonna be happily ever after. And actually that's when the work begins. And so stressing to people that it's okay to come back and make changes to this. We made changes to this months, like almost every few months when we first got married, we made changes to that contract. And then of course, the longer we were married, I noticed that after 10 years, we stopped making that many changes as the kids got older and started graduating. Our changes became less and less. When we got in the military, we stopped making, and it was after the 20-year mark that I noticed that we were not making changes to that contract ever again. Now, and I'm still open because we can make changes to it. Who knows, when grandbabies come along, there may be changes to it, you know, when grandkids come along. But right now, though, it's been sort of solid now with no changes. And there are natural plateaus within a relationship. So we have that 3-point year mark where if we don't have an intervention, relationships typically take a dive and they crash and burn. If there's no intervention to kick it up and reach that 7 to 10 year mark, typically we needed some kind of radical intervention here. If we don't have that radical intervention, you'll watch relationships start to take that dive and they'll crash and burn. But if you have an intervention, you can kick them up to that 15 to 20 year mark. And once they get past that 15 to 20 year mark, you really will see the relationship start to settle down. Because guess why? Kids have moved away, retirements have happened, and so now they're having to sort of relearn each other all over again. And that could be a good or bad thing, because some people decide at that particular time, the kids are gone, I'm done with you. I'm not interested in learning you. I'm gonna start my own life, and they pop smoke. And then you have some people that come in after that particular time in their life because they're trying to learn each other. They want us, they love each other, but they've lost that connection. They don't, you know, they're like two totally different people having to start all over again in life. And so that 20-year mark, you'll notice that they're sort of plateau and stop making changes to this living agreement. But this is, again, where you sort of implement this and put it into practice. And I'm telling you, there's something about having it in black and white and knowing exactly what your spouse expects. So there's none of this, well, I didn't know you didn't like lying. What do you mean? I actually was very explicit in my expectations to you that any form of lying is a violation of our trust. Well, you know what? I only lie to protect you. And guess what? And that's up there. I understand that. You don't. I understand just not telling the whole truth and only a piece of it because you don't want to get into a big argument or a fight. But what we need to be able to do is explain that even when we tell a lie not to hurt the person, it is just as impactful as a whole lie meant to deceive and cause harm. And so if we have this expectation then of how important being open and honest and transparent is, there's no questions about when you lie, you violate my trust. And you know, we call them white lies and all of that, but a lie is a lie. It doesn't matter. A lie is a lie. So having those expectations of knowing exactly what's expected in the relationship is incredibly important. All right, and so they'll do this contract, and it has some things here, just some common things, but really, I tell them, and then come up with your own stuff. Don't just go by what's here. This is just to give you an idea and to get you started. Take some pen and paper and write your own expectations down here. Write down, it's important to know what the deal breakers are. Like, you need to know that if you commit adultery, that's a deal breaker for me. There's no coming back from that. But, you know, we know that that's not the case. People survive adultery every day. You know, people do. We just have to teach them, you know, how to restore trust and things like that. And remember that infidelity is not the problem. Typically, it is a whole nother issue. Infidelity is a symptom of the real problem, is what it is. And Reverend and Adon, you two are right. It really goes back to childhood issues, is what it goes back to. So, but having these expectations, you really decrease the anxiety and the stress in a relationship. You improve the quality of the relationship when people know exactly what is expected of them. And you don't hear that, "I didn't know. That's how you feel? Well, why didn't you tell me that?" You remove all of that because now you know, no, you do know. We wrote it down, we had this conversation, we discussed it. Yeah. Any questions about this? So I talk about what a man needs and what a woman wants because I really sort of hang on to this differences in the sexes. And so I believe that a man has needs and not so much wants and desires because just the way a man thinks, we know that it's more concrete in nature. It's more black and white. But with a woman, it's a little different. Hers can be more wants than anything because they are given to change. And not that that's bad, and I don't mean it disparaging. I mean just because a woman's brain is a lot bigger than a man's. That's what I mean. Is that so, of course, if their brain is bigger, they're going to have a lot of change because they're going to be able to see, oh, this is not working, let me change that. You know, this is not a good idea, let's fix this. Whereas with us, like when we make a decision, we stick with black shoes. And we wear black shoes for 20 years until, you know, we don't even try anything on different, like black shoes or black shoes. This is the only thing you do is black shoes. So our thought is more concrete. And that's the reason why Adon, not to say that it can't change, not to say that that's not possible, but I lean more toward that guys typically think in more concrete terms. And so everything to them is a need. It's not a need, but, you know, in their heads, though, it's a need for them. I need you to respect me. I need you to listen to me and to think that what I have to say is valuable. And it's like, it's a need. You talk to a guy, everything is a need to him. You talk to a guy. But when you talk to a woman, it's a little different. She'll have needs, she'll have wants, she'll have desires, you know, and it's just flexible because she understands that, you know, as the creator of life, there's a lot to take into account than just one simple thing, black shoes, you know? And so that's the reason why I say it. But I think they can be the same thing. I just think that we as sexists, we think about them differently, but they can certainly mean the same thing. And I think more importantly is identifying those deal breakers. Identify early on what the deal breakers are, and so you know to stay away from those. Any other questions? All right, so we will wrap up today's training and make it available for CEUs and for reviewing after this. Workbooks are available. Our website is covenantbehaviorhealth.org. Our Facebook page is Covenant Behavior Health. There's two. There's Covenant Behavior Health US and then just Covenant Behavior Health. Our Instagram is Covenant, it's Disrupting Healthcare, I'm sorry. Our Twitter is Covenant C. So if you have any questions, reach out to us. You can reach us again at covenantbehaviorhealth.org.
Hi, this is Dr. Wilson with the High Desert Professional Counselors Group. Our chapter meets every second Saturday of the month. We are meeting completely online now from 9 to 11 a.m. For more information about joining one of these trainings, that we offer two CEUs per training, you can visit our website at www.covenantbehavioralhealth.org.